Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Chris Evans here. A big thank you for downloading our Virgin Radio podcast. Coming up on this week's edition of The Best of the Breakfast Show with Sky, the hilarious Rob Beckett chatting about his ongoing 100-date comedy tour, Wallop, and shares more than he should do about his upcoming return of Rob versus Romesh. Actual David Schwimmer and Nick Mohammed discussing the hilarious new Sky One comedy, Intelligence. James Norton tells us about his role as a wartime journalist in the brilliant new film Mr. Jones and what he's heard thus far about Mr. Bond. And Tom Kerridge reveals all ahead of this year's Pub in the Park festivals across 8 UK locations, plus Claudia Hammond, Rebecca Front, Alan de Botta and Ralph Little all on the way.
He's a regular face on the telly, he's a regular mouth on the radio, and he's taking both of those parts of his head on the road this year. The latest leg of his monster stand-up tour, Wallop, has just started, and here to tell us all about it is the mouth of the South himself. It's the hilarious and very handsome Mr. Rob Beckett.
Hi, Rob.
Oh, hello.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank
how
you for
are
having
you?
Me. Yeah, really good.
So how has Wallop evolved from 2019 to 2020? Because it always evolves a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's sort of the core of the material's the same, but what happens is I write on stage, so I had a tiny couple of lines about smoking, which has turned into a 10-minute routine.
Ooh, nice.
And it just sort of evolves as I go. So if you come and saw me at the start in 2019 at one of the early gigs in by Leeds, it will have changed. But I can't call it a new show. Some people get a new joke and go, oh, I'll save that for 3 years' time. I can't do that.
Right.
I'm bored of it by then. So
yeah, yeah.
I like to do it and it feels fresh and exciting. And near enough, every show I'll try a new line or a new joke and stuff like that. So it keeps it exciting and fresh for me. And I don't really write anything down. I haven't got that written down, that show.
That I've amazing.
Got bullet points, which is a bit scary and dangerous, but sometimes I start a joke and I remember the end of it halfway through,
yeah.
Which gives me a little kick of excitement,
yeah.
And it makes it feel like it's the first time I've ever said it.
Which is
because
important.
I'm laughing at it again because I've just found out what the
punchline
is because I've said it.
You're like, oh my God, I remember it. Yes.
There's, sometimes you do start, but you go, I don't know how this ends. So you've got to fight, and then you're having like a chat in your head. And then normally I do find the punchline, but
okay.
Yeah.
You say there's just you and Billy Connolly that I've ever met and interviewed and been. Lucky enough to be in the pleasure of, they'd just write bullet points down and go and do 3 hours.
Well, yeah. Oh, well, that's good company
it's
to be in.
Good,
yeah,
isn't it?
I don't know if I'm doing it as well as him, but I'm trying.
Well,
one little trick though that I may do, which he started doing, was he'd on his backdrop would just have a load of random words. It looked like
yes,
but they were the bullet points.
Right.
So if he ever didn't know where he was in the set, he could look around, see a bullet point, and do that routine. That's
so like his
trick.
Own elementary table of comedy.
Yeah, so it was behind him. It looked like random words.
Beautiful.
But to him, it was his like to-do list,
yeah,
for the
his
show.
Yeah, craft.
Yeah.
Do you mind recounting the story of you going to watch the cricket with Romesh?
Oh, yeah. So me and Romesh were in South Africa watching the cricket. And we were watching it. And then I was holding a pint and I went on the big screen. And, you know, I'm going to down the pint, aren't I? I mean,
you have to down the pint.
It's not a thought process for me that is...
Why would you not down the pint?
Well, yeah, exactly. That's more the question, not why did you? So I thought this would be funny. Down that pint. That was officially my first day back at work in 2020 as well.
This is for the Sky Show?
Yeah, so me and Romesh, it's not officially announced, but we were in South Africa watching the cricket and there was a camera crew, so
okay,
make your
Okay, what's
own.
The show called again?
Rob and Romesh Versus.
Right.
So this is an episode about cricket and I was there, I had the pint, downed it, thought I was just on the big screen in the stadium. I wasn't. Live on South African TV, live on Sky Sports in the UK. And then immediately, within 30 seconds, my wife texts me a video of me doing it, going, what's going on here? I was like, how can you be in trouble that quick? But everyone says how amazing technology is. It's terrible.
She watches cricket, does she?
No, she doesn't even like cricket. So someone has filmed it, sent it to her, and then she's sending it. So even just the admin of the copy and paste it on your thumb on WhatsApp. And I thought, how can you get in trouble that quick? Like, I don't want to sound like an old man, but... It was what you could get away with back in the day.
Back
unbelievable.
In the day. All right, so you get up to cricket. What else you get up to this year?
We do ballet and basketball.
Where do you do ballet?
Swan Lake.
Where though?
Oh, in Southampton Mayflower, 2,000 people.
So not like Moscow or somewhere like that.
No, so we went to the Birmingham Royal Ballet Company.
Right, which is fair enough.
To learn, and they're a mate. It's one of the best in the world. And then we get involved in a bit of Swan Lake. But that they are machines. But I never realised how amazing ballet dancers are.
I've hung about with ballet dancers in the past, and what they do is when they've got a big show on, three hours at night, they're rehearsing the next show in the day for the new run, and then when that hits the stage, they double rehearse all the time.
It's insane. There's six days a week they do at this ballet company, and it's like they do 2 hours of warm up before they do any rehearsals. But that's funny. We went to LA for the basketball and did some health treatments out there. I don't want to give too much away, but there may be
Staples Center.
We played basketball at the Staples Center. We went to a clinic and did a colonic, which I think could be one of the best or worst things.
A colonic
irrigation, me and Rosh, which was. Have you ever had a colonic?
Yeah, well, you can have parties, can't you? Where you go with your mates and you sit on cushions and you have a chat. You can actually have a cocktail and stuff, but it's all being done to all of you.
I don't know what they did to me, but there was no way I could have had a chat during it.
Well, you're looking very well, let me tell you.
God.
You look somewhat cleansed.
The only time I've been speechless, it was... I don't know. With a colonic, obviously, we say, but there's a tube involved into an area.
It's a grown-up audience.
Okay, they put a tube in your bum, don't they? Yeah. And then they fill you with water to flush you out, okay? I thought the tube going in would be the worst part. No. Even coming out was hard work, and they just fill you with water. I felt like a pinata, like a watery pinata. Oh, it was awful. Yeah, so me and Robert did that, and then we went to South Africa as well, went on safari. So much amazing stuff on it.
I wonder where they're going to put the colonic episode.
Oh, my God.
Either first or last, it's going to be, isn't it?
I was in pain laughing
first.
At Ramesh getting a colonic.
Go first.
Also,
to be honest,
didn't change, Chris. He looked as miserable as he did hosting the Royal Variety. His face didn't change, but I knew he was sad.
But it was funny about him. He's such a private person, isn't he?
I know.
Personal boundaries are like immense. They're like made of lead, aren't they? For him to open himself up literally to that.
I mean, yeah, and he really opened himself up.
How did they
up.
Get him to do that?
I don't know. I don't know how they get us. I think it's because
maybe it's the new Ramesh.
I think it's because we are proper mates and we have a laugh and get carried away. We're like, yeah, that's because we're so excited to be doing the show together and we love it. I don't know how they get us to do this stuff.
No, I can get. I understand with respect. I understand them getting you to do it, but to get him to do that.
Trying to say, Chris, I'm the kind of guy that just wanders around with his bum out, hoping someone will colonic him.
I'm just saying, Ramesh is he's such a closed book at times, and other times, not so. But I think that's the opening of a new horizon.
It definitely was. It's not fully shut since, to be honest.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Being a spy is all adventure, cocktail parties and concealed weapons, or according to our next guests, the total opposite. The Sky original Intelligence starts later this month on Sky One, and here to tell us all about it, it's writer and star Nick Mohammed, and a man you might recognise if you've ever watched a television. It's David Schwimmer!
Hi, David. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. All right, so Nick, first of all, tell everybody about your show. Now, we've seen a couple of episodes. We love it. It's hysterical. It's awkward. It's naughty. It's everything you want it to be. Where did it come from?
So it came from, I guess, sort of my love of those kind of big institutions where they're quite sort of mundane, I guess, on a daily basis, but actually the backdrop to it is huge. Like, the stakes are huge. So in this case, it's about GCHQ, so national security is a big old backdrop, but you've just got these quite humdrum people sort of going about their sort of daily lives and sort of awkward social conversations.
Yeah, and it is very hum and it is very drum. And we've had our involvement with MI5. They came to see us once.
Did they?
Yeah, they came on the show. They were recruiting for new agents. No, I'm not joking. I'm really, really not joking.
True. Oh, wow.
And they came on the show. We had a special microphone to disguise the voice of the person that we interviewed, but the jobs they were saying are available weren't very James Bond like, and this is the whole point, isn't it? I suppose.
I guess so. I guess GCHQ. I mean, I don't want to sort of speak out of turn because the work they do is extraordinary.
It is absolutely extraordinary and vital to our homeland security.
Absolutely, but
it's not what you think. Maybe
it's more kind of sort of it's quite desk heavy, and there's a lot of number crunching, sort of a lot of sort of data,
office politics,
a lot of office politics. We did lots of research, and GCHQ, I think, have got acquire and do sort of like sort of cake sales.
Now, you don't think this, you know this, because they offered you help, didn't they? They were very they met you in the middle. Unfold your arms.
Yeah, maybe they did, but I think the main thing is that they don't want to be seen to massively endorse the show, because obviously there's quite a lot of artistic license, because I have to say, it's a piece of fiction, but it's based on a real place.
Right.
But yeah, to an extent, they were very forthcoming.
Okay,
very
David Schwimmer, actual David Schwimmer, when and how did you come on board?
I came on board. Nick and I had met on another project. Had a great time, kind of improvising together. I still think he's a comic genius. So he emailed me this idea, and I was like, that's really original and really funny, and let's do it. And then he worked with Expectation Entertainment to form the first outline and treatment, and he sent that along, and I was like, yeah, I'm in. And the idea of working with him as an actor as well, because we both also love to improvise, and some of it, although it's all scripted, there are moments that we get to kind of go off script together and just, you know, play these guys.
It's so obvious and it's so awkward that you go, oh my God. Because the characters are amazing. So first of all, let's outline your two characters.
So I play just a very junior analyst, pretty sort of bad at his job, but I guess sort of has sort of been there for a few years and sort of just want to, because it's public office as well, I guess sort of quite difficult to sort of sack someone. There's probably quite a process to it. It's quite bureaucratic. And, well, Shim can say it, but David plays an quite a high-ranking NSA agent who sort of is...
NSA...
agent, yeah.
NSA means... National Security Agency.
Yeah, so I play this guy... who's very patriotic, narcissist,
misogynist.
Safe to say misogynist, racist, homophobic, power hungry, American, conservative American who has never been...
Way right.
Well, I'm not... We never say exactly explicitly what party he belongs to. But he comes over. He thinks he's been promoted but with this new program in the UK. We come to learn he's actually been demoted and that he's got this backstory which leaks out episode to episode where he's really... They're trying to brush him off and hide him in a way because he's under investigation for interference with the last election.
It's not based on anything real.
I can't think of anything. Nothing comes to mind. No. Not immediately, no. Anyway. I mean, I could give it a bit of thought, but no, not off the top of my head.
Nick, you are
not the tallest man in the world.
No.
Okay.
No.
And David is
and
not.
And I am.
No, no, you're not. But
he's officially the tallest man in the world.
But when you came in today,
yes,
right, I
you
thought,
think it was an optical illusion.
I thought no. But as you walked towards me, you didn't get any bigger. But that's not the point. In the show, do you accentuate the camera shots so you look much more? Because David looks massive.
There was one of them that I think there's a scene where it's as if it's from like a almost like a fisheye lens, like a security camera. The camera's sort of right up in the corner, and it's almost like a fisheye lens. So I think that maybe does. I mean, I'm hoping that's the case, and maybe I'm just really. I mean, I'm 5 foot 4. How tall are you?
6'1".
See, I thought because I presumed you were about that height.
But with the shoes I'm wearing too, I guess 6'2". I mean.
But in the show, you look like 6'5", 6'6". And I thought, Schwimmer's not that big, is he, for heaven's sake?
No.
You're really not.
It's just because I am so small.
I have it in my contract that all cameras have to be very low, so makes me look incredibly tall.
Shorter actors.
You're finishing publicity for this next Wednesday. We have this massive launch of the Sky new season, which is full of absolute stellar content. And it's at the Tate Modern, it's next Wednesday. Then you go back to America, and then you're back here in May, hopefully to film season 2. So you've got to film the whole of the new Friends in March and April. That's incredible, isn't it?
That is incredible.
23 eps in... I mean, I know you're good and you've done it before.
I'm quick. I'm quick. I learn my lines very quickly.
One every 2 days.
Yeah.
So
that's ambitious.
Well, good luck with that.
Cheers.
No, cheers. That's another one. Okay, all right. You're free to go. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
So great. Thank you.
Brilliant.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Our next guest is bringing to life the incredible true story of Welsh journalist Gareth Jones, who in 1933 uncovered the shocking truth around Stalin's atrocities. Mr. Jones is out in cinemas today, and here to tell all is a man that's heavily rumoured to soon be shaken and not stirred. It's the brilliant James Norton.
Yeah, okay, stop that. Stop that, you pesky dapper Dave. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
Okay, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Your film is pretty spectacular and very, very important. Let's tell everybody what it's about.
So it's about a relatively unknown journalist called Gareth Jones, who in 1933 sort of broke into Russia, into the Soviet Union, wandered through Ukraine and discovered what we now know as the Holodomor, which was essentially a man-made famine in which Stalin systematically killed millions and millions of people. And it's terrifying, as we were just discussing, because very few people know really what the Holodomor is, and let alone who Gareth Jones was. And this man was a total hero. He blew the whistle on the Soviet Union, was the first person to do so.
All right, let's talk about the character first of all. So how you portray him. So he's a Welsh chap.
So he was a very earnest, serious, very intelligent man, studied modern languages at Cambridge, was always described as quite short and earnest and bespectacled, with a little notepad, furiously writing away, but was also incredibly brave. And as I say, he kind of went on this mission single-handed, totally on his own accord. And changed the kind of landscape of modern Europe as we know it, but hasn't really been recognised for it.
No, and he was working for the Foreign Office, and he was the most important person advising the Foreign Office at the time. But then he was fired. He was done away with because people thought he was too...
I guess, yeah, in those days, he was a
troublemaker.
He was one of those brazen investigative journalists who wanted to find the truth against, all odds, despite all the risks. And I mean, talk about today, we're discussing about how kind of the relevance of today. He was one of those people who put empirical truth above all agenda and ideology, and paid the ultimate price for that pursuit of truth. He paid his life for it. He died the day before his 30th birthday.
And so how come, who hasn't covered his story, and how come you're getting to tell it now at the cinema?
Well, the tragedy of Gareth Jones, and this is obviously, this is public knowledge, so it's not going to ruin the film. We actually don't really get to this point, but after he had blown the whistle and came back with this truth about the Soviet Union and finally persuaded people that this was ultimately going on and that the collectivization and the Soviet Union were causing these deaths, he then went on another mission when he was 29 into Mongolia, and the day before his 30th birthday, he was shot by a tribe out there. And since then, it's fairly clear that those people were hired by the Soviet Union.
Oh, so really?
They got him in the end, yeah. But that ultimately meant that he had led a very, very short life and died at 29 and never really made his mark beyond this one instance.
So where's the passion come from? Where does the will come to tell this story? Who's the driving force behind this film?
His family, Margaret Coley and Nigel Coley, Gareth's relatives have championed him for years, and they've amassed amazing amounts of resources, and they were incredibly helpful in making the film. And our amazing screenwriter Andrea, she basically was her family from Ukraine originally, and she found this story and has fought for it and
really?
Wrote it. I think it's 12 years in development.
I was going to say, it feels like one of those stories where they've been knocking on as many doors as they can, saying somebody's got to tell this story. It feels like it's got that gravitas behind it.
I think so. And then what was deeply moving was that some of the pieces, for example, there's a scene when, and again, not to ruin anything, but Gareth witnesses a cart being driven through a village. I remember, if you remember that scene.
Yeah.
And it's full of dead bodies, men and women who have starved. And he sees a young child, a toddler, sitting next to his dead mother, and the child is still alive. And these men just throw the dead body onto the cart and then throw the toddler on. And it's horrendous. It's the most horrific, harrowing scene. And Gareth witnessed that. That was a scene, an eyewitness account from Andrea's grandfather. So some of these things which we add to Gareth's journey, and it's most of it is his journey, and some of it is written, and we do take a little artistic license. But to know that was what her grandfather.
So James, you are at the focus. You're in the eye of the sort of showbiz storm that is the next James Bond, and you volunteered this information. You said, "Look, none of it's true." What does that mean? None of it's true. What are you saying? What are you saying here now?
Exactly. None of it is true.
None of it.
Well,
the conjecture's true.
Maybe there is journalists who know more than me, but as far as I am concerned, what they put in the papers is nonsense. I think it's very good clickbait. And if you notice that when anyone's on telly, they're often at the centre of the conversation. But unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever you think, it's people making stories. Okay. I promise you.
No, I get it. I get all that. But I mean, you know, I've been doing this for a while, you know, and you can sort of, you can feel whether the heat is synthetic or whether it's real. To me, there's a sense of reality about this heat because it's coming from certain places and they're staying on it, you know. So, you know, who am I to disagree? Because it's about you and you are you. So, but I would say there is something in it, maybe.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I have not had a single conversation beyond conversations like this.
Right.
So I hope Daniel Craig might do one or two more.
No, that's not going to happen.
Well,
He's not going to do any more.
Maybe there are conversations going on, but they're not involving me.
So you've never had a conversation with anybody about it to do with Eon Productions?
No.
Have you had a conversation with your agent about it?
No.
You must have had a chat about it.
Well, we maybe have like, oh, there's a nut, there's a nut.
No, here we go. So when do you start? You're doing very well, aren't you?
Thanks.
Well done, James.
Likewise.
You've got my vote.
And mine.
And mine.
For anything you would like to do in the future.
Thanks.
You
know, thanks. Appreciate it.
Right, James. James Norton, another round of applause.
Thank you,
James Norton. Thank you very much indeed.
Mr.
Jones, which is a fantastic tale, is out today nationwide.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We've heard from three guests already, but there's loads more still to come. Ralph Little chats all about his new role as D.I. Neville Parker in the latest series of the long-running BBC series Death in Paradise. Alan de Botton tells us how to think more effectively and how to get on with your colleagues with his two new School of Life books. Rebecca Front discusses Sky's hilarious sci-fi comedy Avenue 5. And Claudia Hammond shares the best ways to relax with her new book The Art of Rest. All that and more, but first, Dapper Dave, who's next?
Last year alone, over 120,000 people ate, drank and danced to our next guest's tune, and you can do it all again this year. Tickets are on sale now for his brilliant Pub in the Park Festival, and here to tell us more is a man that knows his way around a muddy field just as well as a busy kitchen. It's the superb Tom Kerridge.
Good morning,
hey.
Tom.
Morning.
What a show to be part of this is. Today,
hey, it's
isn't
amazing,
it?
Isn't it? It's happening next to James Bond. Brilliant. I'm loving this.
Okay, there are rumours about you being the next caterer for the next James Bond.
Yeah, I'm going to do a little van on the outside doing bacon sandwiches for all the actors. I would quite happily do that. I'm not denying that. I'm going to have that conversation with my agent, see if I can make bacon sandwiches for the cast of James Bond. I'm up for that.
There are many, many pubs in Great Britain, thank God. There are too many closing, but that's the way the world is now. But support your local pub if you can. There are many, many pubs and there are many, many parks, but Pub in the Park brings the two cultures together. Boom!
Yes, it's kind of like the greatest pub, beer, garden festival thing that goes on in the summer. We're doing 8 of them this year. And, you know, last year we were so lucky with the weather, the atmosphere, the energy. It's basically you come along, you eat loads of food, you have a wonderful time, you drink loads of booze, and then you listen to great music acts. And it's generally, we just try to create this amazing pub garden effect, and it works so, so well. This is its fourth year. We started it in Marlow, beautiful, on the river, amazing, just did one. Then this year we're doing 8. We're all over the place. We're revisiting Warwick, Bath, Tunbridge Wells, Chiswick and St Albans, but we're going to new places. We're going to Dulwich and Chichester this year as well.
Well remembered.
So, thank you very much. I'd say remembered. I've got a piece of paper in
that
front of me.
That was very impressive.
But thank you very much.
And you have a unique way of selling the food, don't you?
Yeah, so everything's a fiver, basically. You turn up, you come in, and everything's a fiver. It means you can eat in loads of... Basically, I invite all my chef mates, most of which have got Michelin stars or great restaurants, and they turn up and they cook food that they want to eat. So it's kind of like it's fried chicken, it's hot dogs, it's, if you went to a barbecue at their house, in the garden,
this is probably what they've cooked.
That is exactly it. It's like if you're going around a chef's house, right, but like a top chef's house and they're cooking you food, and that's exactly what it is. And everything's a fiver, and you can eat as many different people things as possible. We got Steve Terry, who comes with us on tour everywhere. We got Andrew Prone, we got Angela Hartnett, Claude Bozzi, Out of Culture, Paul Ainsworth. Paul's hosting one of them this year. James Martin is hosting two of them. Marcus Waring is coming along and hosting Chiswick as well. So that we've got some brilliant top chefs cooking some amazing, amazing, amazing food.
But it's funny, isn't it? Because you know, you go to festivals and you go around the corner here, and there's some amazing food at Borough Market available. But you know, £6, £7, £8, but it's special and it's good and it's better than you know, it's a pretty high bar. But this is a fiver, and you don't, it doesn't really get any better. And what's lovely about it is that, and I have no vested interest in this whatsoever, is just that you get the taste that you want for you know, four, five, six mouthfuls, and then you can move on. Because one of the problems with tasting menus when you go to various restaurants is that it takes too long. I call them waiting menus, because you just wait forever, and in the end you feel really weird and full, and you think, oh, I'm not sure I enjoyed that. But this is sort of the opposite.
Yeah, it does, because you can wander around, basically.
You can wander!
You just wander
Don't
around.
Don't wait, wander!
Pick something up, have something to eat, wander off to the next point whilst having a pint of cider on the way.
Bumping into Mark Almond.
Bumping into Mark Almond.
Can't wait.
His 24th solo album.
His 24th solo album.
One on one.
I'm there now. Yeah, it's amazing. Do you know what? Tops it all. We've got Craig David in
my life.
I know. I mean, so for me,
he's playing a lot of them, isn't he, Craig David?
He's doing a DJ set and he's doing Marlowe. He's headlining Saturday night. We've got the Kaiser Chiefs coming back as well. They're doing Chiswick. We've got Basement Jack doing
rude.
DJ
it's
set.
Just rude.
Basement Jack's DJ
You're just
sets
being
are
very rude.
Incredible.
Stop it.
I mean, there's like fireworks and stuff.
Stop it with your brilliant event. Tom, what else should we say about Pub in the Park?
Come and support me, James Martin, Marcus Waring, Angela Hartnett, Paul Ainsworth. Come and eat loads. Come and see Mark Almond, Craig David, Top Loader, Rudimental. Yeah. I mean, there's just so many people
and
coming.
And nobody gives lives better than Mark and Kaiser Chiefs, because they are just tops.
Unbelievable.
Well, we're almost done. So we're almost finished, aren't we, for the day? On the radio, that is. What are you up to for the rest of the day, Tom Kerridge?
I am talking about Pub in the Park a little bit more, and then I'm going into Kerridge's Bar and Grill, where I should be doing service. I shall be in the restaurant in London all day today. So.
How many chefs do you have at the Bar and Grill?
About 18 chefs, by the way.
Yeah. There are other people there too, yeah. But 18 actual chefs.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and how has the Brexit thing gone so far for everything? Has it changed things straight away? Or?
No, it hasn't changed much straight away, although we're all kind of bracing ourselves for price increases and staff issues. And, you know, like The one thing is, it's going to affect everybody, isn't it? You know, it's everybody, everyone in the everything that we're built on for the hospitality industry is based on food and farming. So, you know, we'll wait and see what happens. We'll wait and see what happens.
And then, how's the turnover of staff? Because the one thing about the catering industry, which I've had a bit of experience, as you know, it's keeping staff or almost sort of in a way, the best way to keep them is to tell them. In assure them that they can leave whenever they want, and then they feel less pressure to have to stay, but then ironically they stay for a bit longer.
Yeah, we're hugely supportive of staff that are in the business, that people that have been with us for a long, long time. We've got people that have been with us for decades and they grow. We're really into personal and professional growth within the company, so people that want to do their own thing, we'll encourage them to get as much training as they can with us, learn as much as possible, and then we'll actively help them try and find their own space if they want to, or do what they want to do and make sure that they're looked after. And at the same point, that way you having key staff and keeping them growing within the business is really important, because then when people come through and guests come through the door, they recognize a face and the face gets recognized, and it just makes everything a nicer place to be.
Well, I know, because I frequent your places too far too often, but I love it. Friday nights, me and Tash, best time ever, thanks to Tom. I mean, and my wife obviously, but mostly Tom. No. I didn't mean that. She knows. She knows I didn't mean that. Well, Tom, thanks for coming. You're always welcome. You know that.
Thank you.
And I'll
so
see you.
Much.
By the way, do you want to sell the boat? Your boat?
To be honest, my boat's gone. And I tell you
what, in the river, the flood.
Yeah, the flood came. We woke up one morning, looked out the window, and Beth went, "The boat's gone." I was like, what? So the boat had gone, right? So we got a tiny little boat, right? And it was attached to the pontoon. And actually, it wasn't just the boat had gone. The boat and the pontoon, the whole thing had gone. Disappeared down the river.
No way.
It has been found. Don't worry. It has been found. But yeah, the whole thing...
Oh, so that was lovely as well.
See, yeah, you know, someone will repair it. It'll turn up. It was fine.
All right.
Why, do you want to buy a boat?
No,
you did, but not now.
Well, to be honest, I was at the market for one, but I found one about a mile down the river last Tuesday.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
He shot to fame over 20 years ago in the royal family and now joins the long-running hit show Death in Paradise, which continues tomorrow night on BBC One. Here to explain just how awful it is filming on a beautiful Caribbean island, please welcome the man with the worst job in the world. It's Ralph Little.
Morning, Ralph.
Hello.
So, Ralph, you have bagged one of the best jobs on the telly.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, it's like, you know, it's the Bond, it's the bagging the Bond version job of telly, isn't it? So yes. if people don't know what Death in Paradise is, why don't you tell them?
Oh, Death in Paradise is a now long-running BBC One detective show set in the fictional Caribbean island of Saint Marie, filmed on the real Caribbean island of Guadeloupe, which is a French Caribbean island. And I play the latest in a line of British detectives that go out to... usually end up going out there to solve crimes against British holidaymakers or expats, and then end up staying and working on the island. It's basically Columbo in the Caribbean.
It is Columbo in the Caribbean, and some, to say the least. So, yeah. So when you tell us about the moment you get a call to go and work as an actor, for what doing what you do for a living in the Caribbean and getting paid for it.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I have to say, it was sort of May last year, I was in Ireland. I was going down the west coast of Ireland with my girlfriend, who's American. And she wanted to see the west coast of Ireland. And like you do if you're British, you're a bit like, oh, Ireland's not very... You sort of take things for granted when you're over here. And I was driving down the west coast of Ireland going, this is amazing. Why have I never been here before? And we were in Dingle Bay, and we were about to go and see the dolphin that lives in Dingle Bay, Fungi the dolphin. And we were parking up in the drizzle and the rain. And I was going, this is still going to be a good day, even though it's raining. And I get a call, it's my agent, and they went, so you're the new detective in Death in Paradise. I was like, this is the best day ever. And now I get to see a dolphin. So, yeah, it was surreal and brilliant and... yeah, just pretty unbelievable.
So you don't become the same DI as the last one. You're a new DI.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And so Arden leaves. Well, he left last week.
Yeah.
How did he? I didn't see episode four. How did he go?
Ardle left for love. Well, he sort of fell in love and then wasn't sure if he was going to stay. Wasn't sure if he was going to leave. He'd had a tragedy. Lost his wife. So in the end, it was like for him, it was time to go back and reconnect with the reality of his life that he was running away from.
Right, and your DI is, you are DI Neville Parker.
Neville Parker, yes.
Tell us about, why Neville Parker? Did you discuss the name or was it just thrust upon you?
Actually, I didn't get to discuss that. I was very lucky I got to develop the character with the producers. They were great about that. But no, the name was already set. Neville Parker.
Nosy Parker. Yeah, nosy exactly. Neville Parker.
Oh, you know what? I didn't even think about that, but that might stick now.
Gary
now.
Neville Parker.
Yeah.
Phil Neville Parker. Neville Parker.
Yeah.
Isn't that called Neville Neville?
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah.
And their sister?
Tracy Neville.
Tracy Neville.
Yeah.
Very successful, of course. Yeah. In her own right, in the sporting world. So you arrive for a one-off case.
Yes, so the idea is somebody in Saint Marie, the fictional island, it's a suspected suicide. The police think it's a suicide. It has all the hallmarks of a suicide. It looks like a suicide. Open and shut case, but the victim's from Manchester, so they need somebody from Manchester CID, which is me, to come over and sign it off, basically. Come in and go, yep, I agree, sign the form, and fly home again. So Neville's only really supposed to be there for, like, 2 hours and then leave.
And he really doesn't want to stay.
He really doesn't want to stay. But because of his brilliance, his detective brilliance, he spots some... there's one little detail that he spots that he just can't let go of, and he's like, something's not right here, and he won't sign it off, and he's like... I think this is a murder case. And so they say, all right. And he still wants to leave. And they go, well, if it's a murder case, you're going to stay and solve it. He's like, no. That's not my job. I'm supposed to need to go back. And they're like, it is your job. You're here now. So that's how he ends up staying, at least for a few weeks.
And then they offer to put him up in the most beautiful beach hut you've ever seen in your life. Please tell me that really exists and they didn't just make it for the show.
Well, they did. They build it for the show.
Oh.
It exists. It's a real shack on the beach, and it's absolutely stunning, right on the beach. And I, when I've had my first day,
reminds you are getting paid for doing all this.
Honestly, it's ridiculous. Every location you go to, you go, really? We're filming here? And this shack on the beach that I just walked in, and you know, it's a famous place in the show, which has been, you know, nine seasons of this show, so people love the shack on the beach where the detective lives. And I walked in, and you know, I'm a fan of the show. I was like, I cannot believe I'm here. And I looked, and I was genuinely saying to the producers, like, look, I mean, I don't need to stay like in the hotel. I'll stay here. And they're like, look, it's not insured. It's not a real, it's not plumbed in. Yeah. And I was like, please, is there any chance I can stay here? I think probably the reality of it would be a little bit mosquito-y and hot. But apart from that, it's stunning.
Before you go, tell us about the most needless caveat clause negotiated into an actor's contract on your behalf by your agent.
The 3-year thing. So my agent was like, okay, well, they've asked for 3 years for you to sign a contract, you know, assuming it goes well. I mean, if I'm terrible in the show, then they'll sack me. They've asked for 3 years. And my agent was like, but I've managed to sort of negotiate that down. And in case, you know, you don't want to go back. And I was like, why would I not want to go back? I can't. I mean, we'll see. But my girlfriend was like, maybe you'll be working in America. And I was like, maybe, but maybe. I'm pretty sure I'm going to be wanting to do this.
Well, Ralph, well done, mate.
Thanks,
really,
man.
I'm really pleased for you.
Thanks.
Death in Paradise is back tomorrow, episode 5. It's Ralph's first one is the brand new D.I. Neville Parker. NBC One's 9th series of the long-running drama Death in Paradise, episode 5 of 8 is tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on BBC One. And all going well, Ralph will be there for a couple of years to come.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
If you've watched a brilliant British comedy in the last 20 years, our next guest has most likely been in it. She stars in the new Sky One space comedy Avenue 5, which continues tomorrow night at 10 p.m. So without further ado, please bow, curtsy, tip your cap, sit back and enjoy the comedy legend that is Rebecca Front.
Morning, Rebecca!
I love that introduction.
Welcome. Come closer to the microphone so we can get
Can you just greet me like that
front.
Every morning?
Yeah,
I would
he
love
will,
that.
He will, for a price. So Rebecca, Armando Iannucci, he was on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about Avenue 5 and you've worked with him before. Is it always the same kind of experience or is it different depending on the project?
This was a bigger scale project. I mean, broadly, the Armando experience is always similar, which is basically he surrounds himself with very, very nice, very, very funny people. So you have a lovely, lovely time.
Oh,
that's the Armando experience,
good.
With a bit of improv and a bit of kind of, you know, you never quite know where you're going with it. And it's great. But the scale of this is quite different from knowing me, knowing you or anything that we did back in the day.
So for people who aren't aware of Avenue 5, A, why not, especially if you have Sky, but B, can you tell them about it, please?
Avenue 5 is set 40 years in the future on a space cruise ship. So it's all very glitzy, very smooth. Everything's wonderful. Hugh Laurie is our captain. We're all having a wonderful time. And then something goes fractionally wrong. But if something goes fractionally wrong in space, it goes massively catastrophically wrong. And we're knocked off course. And suddenly we find that we're not on a 6-week cruise. We're actually going to be stuck up there for 3 years.
So it's HBO. It's an HBO and Sky production, which is why we get it weekly. We can't devour all the episodes at once because HBO still love the old fashioned way of linear broadcasting, which is why Curb Your Enthusiasm, episode 2, season 10, is only available today, as opposed to, again, you know, all available last week when season 10 started. Not dissimilar with your show.
That's right.
And so we're looking forward to Wednesday at 10 p.m. Sky One for HBO and Sky's third episode in 9 episodes of the first season of Avenue 5. Now, how's it gone down in America? Have you been to America to do any promo?
Yes, we went about 2 weeks ago. There was a big launch. This is my first American TV thing. So I've done, you know, a lot of press launches in the UK and I've done American movies, but I've always been a fairly small part. So I haven't kind of done big press launches. So that was a whole other thing.
Tell us about it, because I've done a couple of those in the past.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. I mean, I loved it. I actually really loved it. You know, they fly you out on a swanky plane and you turn left when you go on. Never turned left on a plane before. And then it's kind of lovely hotel suite. And they sent me this thing saying, you know, would you like to select which hair and makeup team you would like? And I was thinking, do I have to pay for this? Because I haven't got that kind of money. But these lovely, lovely, wonderful guys turned up, you know, the first morning with wheelie cases and, you know, hot rollers and makeup things. And
not that you need it, Rebecca.
Great.
Come on. Not
yes,
that Rebecca
I know, I
needs
waiting.
It.
I for heaven's
sake. But it was come fabulous. On, guys. Jeez,
I just thought, I could live with this. I could have this every day.
It
that
is,
would be all right.
They do it differently in Los Angeles.
They really do.
They just do, don't they? That's the thing. And because it's HBO, it's a 7-year, potentially a 7-year deal, Rebecca.
Potentially, yes. It is a sort of like a golden handcuff, which is kind of wonderful. I mean, there's other stuff. I can do lots of other stuff, but in terms of telly, there are certain limitations. But I've never had anything like that placed on me before, so it's kind of quite exciting.
Now, Hugh, of course, signed up for House, and that was a 7-year deal. And I remember him talking to us about it, saying, you know, well, I didn't think it would last for 7 years, but of course it did, didn't it?
Yeah.
And his was 20-odd episodes a year for 7 years, and you have to stay, and your family have to stay. This was over in Los Angeles, of course, but you're filming here, so it's a different kettle of fish. Mm. Have you talked to him about the 7-year phenomenon?
I know that, because I'd probably heard him talking to you about it, in fact, so I know that it is quite a big deal. I think, I mean, I've always avoided what they call pilot season, you know, where you go over and you just try out lots of pilots because you have to sign up for those deals.
Yeah.
Now, I wouldn't mind quite so much because my kids have, you know, flown the nest and they're at university and so on. But when the kids were little, my American manager would ring up and say, come over and do this. And I just used to go, but I can't make that work, because if it did get picked up, I'm going to be away from my kids for months and months and months on end every year for 7 years. I won't do it. So I just didn't for a long time. But now I sort of think, you know, actually, if something like that came up, I probably would be a bit more tempted to go for it. But it's very, very difficult to make that work with normal life, I think.
And so what things were you nearly in?
I don't know if I can talk about any of that. Most cases, actually, I didn't go for it at all. I didn't try it.
What kind of programmes were mentioned?
Fraser. No, the only one that I really regret trying was Marvellous Mrs. Maisel. There was a part, which I won't say what part it was. I wouldn't have got it anyway, because the person who got it is a genius. But it was a thing in that, and that was something where I did kind of think, oh, maybe. But anyway, but no, other than that, I think because I've been in this business so long, I've got quite good at just putting things out of my mind. If I decide not to go for a part, or if I do go for it and don't get it,
yeah,
I'm quite good at just thinking, okay, move on, because otherwise you would drive yourself a bit crazy.
You don't do buyer's regret then? You're quite good at that.
Yeah, I think I've got very good at just thinking, no, it's fine. This is all good. It's all, you know, it's all happened for a reason.
All right, Rebecca, lovely to see you again.
Lovely to see you.
As always, thank you. Rebecca Fromm, what a lovely lady, what a great guest.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
If you think you can think, then think again. Our next guest has a brain to be admired and is kind enough to share its goodness with us all. The latest releases in his School of Life series, How to Think More Effectively and How to Get On With Your Colleagues, are out now. So dishing out philosophy for you and for me is the wonderful Alain de Botton.
Good morning, Alain.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Two amazing books, How to Get On With Your Colleagues, A Guide to a Better Collaboration, and How to Think More Effectively. How do these books come about? How are they compiled?
Me and my team at the School of Life, we analyse human suffering and we think, where's it most intense? And we try and respond with some thoughts. We're in the business of trying to fix people with ideas.
Okay.
So that's what we do.
All right. And one of the main crimes that we commit against ourselves nowadays is we suffer our success.
Yes, we suffer our success. Absolutely. We don't allow ourselves to fail well. You know, we hear so much about good success. We don't hear about good failure.
Yeah.
Good failure is something where we learn, where we accept our imperfections. We have a very hard time accepting that other people who we admire are just as frightened as we are. We tend to assume that the fear is all on our side. It isn't. It's universal.
What about setting off on the wrong path without knowing it? There's a very frightening paragraph in the first chapter of the book about how to think more effectively on strategy.
Well, look, the thing about thinking is we've all got very large brains. We just don't use them, which sounds a little bit rude, but it's accurate. We tend to define our goals in incredibly vague terms and then are surprised when we don't quite reach our destination. Part of the reason why we don't think more sharply than we do is because of anxiety. It's very scary to think. We will do almost anything other than... We love acting and we hate thinking. And the reason is that every time you think boldly and adventurously, you're likely to be questioning some part of your life which is probably in need of attention. Maybe you need to do something in your relationship, take a new tack in your career or something. And we're so scared of doing this that we will check our phones, empty the biscuit tin, etc. Anything other than use our brains. in order to relax ourselves, you know, it's very odd. People don't tend to work very well in offices. This is, you know, a fact. Now, why is that? It's partly because you're meant to think. Whenever you're meant to do something, it becomes scarier and therefore we get more reluctant. That's why showers are the new offices. I mean, the shower, simply on the basis of how many good thoughts you have in there, are, you know, probably responsible for more good thinking than the average office. And that's paradoxical. It's almost as if when the pressure's off, when we're on a train somewhere and we're just looking at the landscape flashing by, or in a cafe and there's a little bit of background buzz or something, that's when the mind's sort of nervous, skittish, controlling sense relaxes and some of the good thoughts that we have get through. They also get through at 3 a.m. I mean, insomnia broadly is a kind of revenge for all the thoughts that you, in inverted commas, forgot to have in the day. And there they come at 3 a.m. and they need to be heard. So, you know, good thinking is often anxiety-inducing. We don't want to do it, but it's got an important lesson. Think of breakdowns. You know, a breakdown is very often a breakthrough that hasn't found a legitimate way to get to consciousness. So when people suddenly go mad, they can't get out of bed anymore, they fall into a depression, they go manic, etc. Often it's because there's something about their life that they want to change, that those thoughts have not been allowed calmly into consciousness. And then in the end, they just burst through. And it looks like it's a disaster, and it's certainly very difficult, particularly for those around. But often, it's a process of growth.
Right. Where do we start with this book? It's all about the workplace, our unhappy past. I mean, the thing about this book, I enjoyed it immensely. I found that, How to Think More Effectively an easier read, funnily enough, because this is like a miniature course in psychology, isn't it? You really go for it here.
Well, and also, you know, office politics. The thing about offices, right, is that we all gossip about people around us. And we try and say in the book that gossip is a slight despairing move where you've sort of given up trying to change anything. And all you do is just sort of say, that one's crazy, that one's crazy, that one smells, that one, you know. And this is what we spend a lot of time doing in offices. I think behind the scenes, what we know is human beings bring the whole of themselves into work, and human beings are massively complicated. And we keep having this idea that professional life can be relatively simple. Oh, you know, we're going to work, so work's going to be the easier, but work's going to be easier than relationships. No, 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 it's going to be even harder, and you can't talk about the stuff. So, you know, to anyone who's running an office, one of the best things to do is to put a large sign over the door saying, everybody here is crazy. So that at least sets the tone, because some of the thing that gets in the way of sort of sanity in offices is the assumption that, you know, we can't talk about stuff and that there's no weird stuff going on. Of course there is. Everybody's bringing themselves to work, which means their past, their five-year-old self, their problem with their father, their, you know, fear about whatever. And so the book goes through a number of things that we probably all recognize if we've spent more than 5 minutes in an office. For example, the defensive character. If there's one psychological problem that, you know, more than any other gums up office life, it's defensiveness. And defensiveness goes like this. You say to somebody, you know, I love this thing, it's fantastic, but, you know, paragraph three, could you change the last sentence? They go, that's fine, all right. And you know you've pressed some button, some nerve. And that's because a part of them, they haven't heard, please change paragraph three. They've heard in their sort of ancestral mind, you don't deserve to exist and I hate you. Now, where's that voice come from? It's probably come from somebody who looked a bit like you that they knew when they were seven. But none of that, it's difficult, isn't it? That's why work is difficult. We can't get to these sub-layers, right? The other thing that goes on in offices is that all of us have to be teachers, right? But one of the most puzzling things, it happens in personal life as well, is other people cannot read your mind. It's very odd. Small children always think that adults can read their mind. It takes them a long while to realize, unless I speak and say what I think, you know, etc. But in offices, there are people nursing the most humongous sulks. They imagine that somebody to whom they've never taught something, how they feel, how they want something done, what they prefer, should somehow be miraculously reading their intentions and be taking appropriate action. How can they? They've not been taught.
We've got to stop it there, but Alan, as always, absolute joy to listen to you, to be in the same room as you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. If you like Alan de Botton, the cut of his jib, he will be at lifelessonsfestival.com, and you can go there for your ticket bundles right now.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Our next guest will be talking R&R at Life Lessons Fest next weekend, and if her book, The Art of Rest, How to Find Respite in a Modern Age, is anything to go by, you should really pay attention. Please welcome a lady that's bursting with the facts on how to chillax. It's the best of the rest, Claudia Hammond.
Good morning, Claudia.
Good morning.
Welcome to the show. So, Claudia will be twice appearing at lifelessonsfestival.com, and it's a weekend this weekend. So it's on Saturday the 15th and 16th of Feb. Tickets still available at lifelessonsfestival.com. So many brilliant speakers, so many amazing brains under the same roof in the same 36 hours. Let's get the list of the big hitters, including Claudia, who's here now. So, The Art of Rest. Sounds simple, is simple, but has been forgotten and is being forgotten. Tell us about your research first, Claudia.
So, what we did with a group of psychologists from Durham University, we created a big survey online called The Rest Test, and 18,000 people from 135 different countries filled it in, which surprised us a lot. And we found that two-thirds of people said that they wanted more rest. So this means rest while you're awake, not sleep, but anything you do while you're awake that you find relaxing. And one of the things we looked at was the activities that people found were most restful. And in the book, I count down Sunday chart style from 10 down to 1, those top 10 activities. And what people need to do is to pick the activities that will work for them. They won't all work for everybody. But there are some real surprises that are in there and not in there. So socialising with friends, which you think, oh, that's nice and relaxing, that doesn't come in the top 10. In fact, the top 5 activities are all things we tend to do on our own, suggesting that partly to rest, we want a bit of a rest from other people and a bit of a break from them.
I like DNIP is my favourite. Your DNIP, do nothing in particular.
That's right.
I love that. And I do, I've just started doing that at weekends. Obviously you end up not stopping. But imagine if you'd have organised to do things as well. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Let things find you almost.
I think that's the trouble. I think that being busy has become a bit of a badge of honour. We want to be busy all the time, and we think that makes us, you know, look important and valued and gives us status, when in fact what we need to do for the sake of our mental health and cognitively, so that it, you know, improves our memory if we have breaks, but yet we don't want to have breaks. We see rest as something we should only do when we've done everything else, but I think we need to start taking it seriously and mapping in when will you rest, as well as when will you do things and be busy.
And it's funny, isn't it, because if you do something that seems not meaningless, but not that important. But if the side effect of that is you becoming rested or gaining some perspective, then it is very important. So because the byproduct of it is so useful. So on Friday, I was a bit stressed with something that was going on last week. It was a good thing, but it was taking me over, which I didn't like. It was a very, very good thing, actually. But I didn't like it because it was bringing me out of presence. It was making me unconscious, which sounds bizarre, because I was focusing on that instead of just being here now. And it was my little boy's birthday party on Saturday, and we hadn't finished his blimmin' scale exercise track because it's so complicated, and it's really complicated. And he had to go on a cross-country run after school, so I spent the whole of Friday afternoon, and I should have been focusing on this other thing, part of the world would say, oh, you need to be doing this. And I thought, no, I've got to do this track because it's really important, it's his birthday party. And I spent 3.5 hours doing it, and I didn't finish it properly, and he had to finish off because he knows it better. He knows his track inside out, and I don't. But the three and a half hours flew by, and by the time I'd stopped doing it, I was completely back in the moment. And the other thing that was supposed to be important, you know, it had been quite rightly put in its place by whatever it is that I'd been helped with. And I thought, wow, that's so simple. And it seemed so menial what I was doing, but actually it was really, really important for a load of silent reasons.
Yeah, and that was restful, the thing you were doing, because it completely absorbed you. And if you can find those activities, you know, the psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi called this flow, where you find the activities that completely absorb you. You don't even notice, you're sort of out of time. It's not that time goes fast or goes slowly. You don't even really notice it going. And that might be painting for one person, or gardening for another person, or making scalextrics for someone else. It can be any of these things that really allow you to stop worrying. It's mostly about these thoughts that go around in your head, worrying often about the future. If you can find the thing that stops those just for a while, and not all the time, it's all about getting the rhythms of rest and activity. So in fact, in our survey, the people who got too much rest, if you like, where the rest was probably forced upon them, so perhaps they were ill and couldn't do very much, or perhaps they were unemployed and didn't want to be and didn't have very much to do, their well-being was lower again. So there's a sort of perfect point of the amount of rest that you can have.
Right, final chapter is very important.
The final chapter is finding the perfect prescription for rest. So finding the perfect prescription for you, because the same activities won't work for everybody. So it's a question of thinking which of these activities are the ones that are really allowing me to relax and stop worrying, mainly, and to find those activities. And then to say, oh, I'm going to prescribe myself 15 minutes of that activity. So the thing I really like is gardening. I've got a tiny garden. But now, if I'm, say, working at home, when I should be working, I'll allow myself to go outside for 15 minutes, start doing stuff in the garden, and just think, this is good for my... I'm not going to feel guilty. This is good for my mental health. And this is what I'm going to prescribe myself. This is my excuse anyway. And then the moment I do that, you can feel this sort of... I feel this wave of calm coming over me. And that will be different things for different people. And it's the question of finding what that is, giving yourself permission to do it and allowing that. And also accepting that your to-do list... This sounds depressing, but your to-do list will never end. So people will often think, well, I'll stop when I've got through the whole list. But even if you can get through your whole list one day, there will be more on it the next day, because unexpected things will happen for the rest of your life. Pipes will leak. People will get ill. All sorts of things will happen.
Shut up, Basil Ehrman. And pipes will leak. People will get ill. Politicians will philander.
And we need to accept those things.
I love that.
So accept your list.
Okay, great. Lovely to talk to you, Claudia.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Thank you so much for listening to this, the podcast of the Virgin Radio Breakfast Show. Don't forget, you can subscribe and get it every week from wherever you get your podcast, and you will never miss the weekly roundup of all the best bits from our Virgin Radio Breakfast Show with Sky.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.